This episode of The Last 2 Years is brought to you by DNI.
Feeling good about your career? Do you have an impressive resume and an exciting list of accomplishments? Have you set yourself up for higher and higher levels of success and acclaim for the rest of your life?
Boring. Hard work and success are for suckers. Why not try working for DNI? Do Nothing Incorporated. Quit all the things that make you valuable to society. Move back in with your mom and pretend it's summer vacation. Forever. Do Nothing Incorporated. Stare into the void of your unvarnished soul and confront your inner emptiness. Don't feel so good about yourself anymore, do ya? Do ya?
It's September 9th, 2018, and Christian and I are standing behind a podium getting fitted with microphones. Tonight is the launch event for the book we've just finished on the LA art world. And it's fancy. There are waiters at the door handing out glasses of champagne, and caterers moving through the crowd with silver trays of hors d'oeuvres. There are over 150 guests, all dressed nicely, hobnobbing. All around them, suspended from the walls and ceiling, are huge posters featuring quotes and photos from our book. At 7 o'clock, the guests sit down, and our boss, Roberta, gets up to speak. We met her and her husband, Howard, through a mutual friend at the end of 2016. We were a Harvard-educated lawyer and designer. The Amundsens were philanthropists with their own foundation. And they liked us right away. So much so that they created this book project to help launch our careers as cultural researchers and consultants. And standing in front of the crowd that night, there's no doubt they've done just that. Tonight, we are authors, celebrating the end of one successful project and the beginning of many more to come. There's no way for us to know what tonight actually marks the beginning of the most difficult and painful year and a half of our lives. In just a few weeks, Christian and I will stop working indefinitely. And that decision will change everything. If you've listened to episode one, you'll know that we decided to stop working because we felt like God told us to. And because, by this point in our lives, we'd developed a habit of doing what we thought God was saying, even if it meant taking a risk. What you don't know yet is how. How did we come to believe God was telling us not to work? And what happened after that? That's what this episode is about. So, without further ado, let's begin. Episode 2. Tanuki suit. I'm going to take you on a little journey through time, so stay with me. Our first stop, December 2017, just 3 months into our book project. One night, Christian and I go to dinner with some new friends from church. At the end of the dinner, our friend Doe suggests praying and asking God for prophetic words for each other, which, if you haven't gathered by now, is pretty common practice amongst charismatic Christians. So we start praying for each other, and our friend Edison says this: "I see a picture of a bunch of stepping stones across a body of water. You guys are walking on them. It's dark, so you can't see what's ahead. But whenever it's time to take a step, the next stone lights up in front of you. I feel like God is saying, you don't need to worry about what's next after this project. He'll show you where to go." At this point, Christian and I aren't even thinking about what might be next. We're only a few months into a year-long project. But it's always nice to hear that you don't have to worry about the future, so we make note of the word. I write it down. Fast forward 9 months to August 2018, just 3 weeks before our book launch. That day, we run into two different people at church, each of whom gives us a prophetic word about how God is going to transition us into our, quote, next thing in His timing. And we don't need to worry about how to get there. I actually recorded one of them on my phone.
I feel like he's saying that it's not that you're anxious, but just know that you can go ahead and rest. That as you rest, he's going to make it really clear where to go next and what to do next. But it's going to be an easy transition.
The other word, from a complete stranger who hadn't heard the first, is similar. I see you riding a bike from this season into the next one. The transition is going to be easy. You won't have to worry about how to get there. Finally, September comes. We print our book, have a successful launch event, and for reasons unrelated to the story at hand, move out of our place in LA. And instead of searching for a new apartment right away, we decide to put our stuff in storage and go on a month-long vacation. For the first 2 weeks of our vacation, we travel all over Slovenia. We even take a day trip to Venice to meet up with the Amundsens. Driving through the fog-drenched mountain passes of Slovenia, past valley after lush valley watered by impossibly blue rivers, we strategize. At this exact moment in our lives, our careers are on an upward trajectory. We've gone from Harvard to well-paying, custom-made jobs. We've become friends with billionaire philanthropists who've introduced us to all kinds of influential people, and we've just published a book. The future is rife with possibility, and we want to be ready. So, we strategize. We make lists of people to reach out to, new project ideas, ideas for getting our book distributed. There's only one problem. Whenever either of us pray about the future, we both hear the same thing from God. Wait. It's time to rest. That's when we remember the prophetic words we've gotten over the past year about stepping stones and smooth transitions. In hindsight, it's like we were being primed to make this decision long before it actually happened. By the time we got to Slovenia, the idea of stopping and resting didn't seem all that crazy. We'd already gotten multiple words about rest and an easy transition. We'd just worked really hard and published a book. All of those factors seemed to weigh in favor of taking a little break and waiting for God to show us the next thing. So at the end of October, when we returned from our vacation, all of our stuff still in storage, we decided to crash at my parents' house for what we assumed would be a few weeks and try resting.
When I think of rest, when I think of rest, I think of a hammock. And a hammock next to a lightly babbling stream. I think about being suspended there.
I think of the image of me lying down next to a body of water, enjoying the sun.
Waking up whenever my body naturally wakes up, cooking something for breakfast or picking something up for breakfast if I'm just not in the mood to cook that day, reading, drinking coffee.
Going to a restaurant by myself and, you know, ordering an appetizer along with entree, you know, it's just something simple as that. It's just eating. I enjoy eating. I think resting for me also looks like sitting on a couch, watching a movie, or going in my backyard at nighttime and just looking up at the stars while everybody else is sleeping, just chilling and just letting my thoughts run wild.
Early Saturday morning, taking a long walk. And not worry about time, distance, and just keep on walking.
Here's what rest looked like for me. Waking up around 10 or 11 every morning. Eating brunch. And then basically spending the day doing random stuff. Reading, going to a coffee shop, journaling, seeing friends, maybe going to the beach. Eventually, it would be time for dinner. Then maybe a movie or a book before bed. And then I'd go to sleep so I could wake up and do it all over again the next day. Maybe all that sounds amazing to you. Once upon a time, when I had a job with deadlines and a seemingly endless to-do list, this lifestyle would have sounded amazing to me too. But in the context of indefinite unemployment, it was awful. Every morning I woke up with the feeling that time was closing in on me, squeezing the air out of my lungs. A few weeks turned into a month, then 2 months, then three. All the while, for the first time in my life, I had nothing to work toward, no goal to accomplish. I didn't know what to do with myself. But more than that, I didn't know who I was. So much of my life until then had centered around being productive. Now, suddenly, I was doing nothing. At first, I tried thinking of creative projects to accomplish. I could learn a new language, start running, learn to play the mandolin, finally do the podcast I'd always talked about. Anything that could help me emerge from this break a better, more impressive version of myself. But every time I tried to start, I would feel God say the same thing to me. Gently, but always firmly. Wait. Rest. You don't need to do anything. For me, God's voice shows up most often as a strong gut feeling, a deep, sure knowing that seems to come from inside and outside of me at the same time. Almost like a memory, but from someone else's mind. Once, in high school, I got into a huge fight with my dad. I sat in my room, stewing, thinking of all the reasons why he was horrible and I hated him. And from almost out of nowhere, I had this thought. Go to his room and tell him you love him. Immediately, tears came to my eyes, tears of indignation and anger. Because I knew it was God telling me to do it. And I knew, without a doubt, that it was the right thing to do. But at that moment, I felt like I'd rather jump off a cliff than tell my dad I loved him. I sat there for about 20 minutes, crying and resisting. And then I got up, dried my eyes, crept down the hallway to my parents' room where my dad was lying in the dark, not sleeping, and told him I loved him. He didn't receive it particularly well. I think he grunted in reply. But right after I said it, I felt better, lighter. I knew it had been the right thing to do. Now, that same voice, that same knowing, like a low, persistent hum emanating from my chest through my whole body, was telling me that I was doing the right thing by doing nothing. But this time, instead of feeling better, I felt worse.
So my first question is, when we told you at the beginning that, you know, God told us to rest and he told us not to work, what did you think?
I think
I interviewed my parents last week over Zoom. Because in case you've forgotten, this horrifying endless summer vacation was taking place in the home of two immigrants from Taiwan, both with PhDs, who had been so proud of me when I'd graduated from Stanford and Harvard and had no grid for what I was doing now. That mounting sense of anxiety I felt as the weeks turned into months with still no sign of our next opportunity, it wasn't just coming from me. It was radiating from my parents like heat from a rapidly spreading wildfire.
That's just how we are.
Well, at first, I think that's fine because you guys had a very busy year. So I think that's good. That's a good idea.
I was nervous doing this interview. For a long time, this topic was almost impossible for me and my parents to talk about without getting into a fight. I was afraid I'd get angry again, or worse, start crying.
So I think, okay, that's fine. You know what you're doing. So I just try not to say anything.
So it sounds like at the beginning, you both thought it was a good idea. Obviously, at some point, you both started to feel very uncomfortable with us continuing to rest. So can you pinpoint when that started?
Maybe after the holidays, in the beginning of 2019, I think. You guys were not doing anything, okay, just like waiting. But I started to feel kind of weird.
For me to see, you know, two talented, well-trained young professionals not working, it just, you know, doesn't make sense. You know, I've been working all my life, and in my assessment, you ought to go there, you know, out there to get a job, to really work hard, you know, to build a future for yourself.
So working hard, building a future for yourself, being successful, what does that mean?
To be successful, you got to do better than your parents. Number two, you got to be able to do better than your friend, your peers. Okay. They went to the same school, same education. Okay. Like people graduate from Stanford. You should do better than they to be called successful.
No, that's interesting. I didn't know that you thought that I should do better than my Stanford peers. Like, you mean like make more money than them?
Not just make more money, because people don't know exactly how much, you know, your peer is making. But when people talk, oh, Christina, she has this, she has done this, okay, she's working for this, you know, or she already got house, already bought a house in a nice neighborhood. All this, okay. So everything is not just material wise, just everything. Okay. I expect you to do better.
At this point in the conversation, I could feel my insides clenching up. I wanted to stop my parents and say, are you listening to yourselves? How dare you put so much pressure on me? Thankfully, I was on mute. Because the point of this conversation was not to get into an argument. I wanted to understand where my parents were coming from.
All your life, I, as a mom, have prepared you, you know, from preschool. I send you to the, you know, the best preschool I can possibly find, right? And then got you into the Montessori and the APPAS. And then for junior high, we even drove you to OSHA. It's like, I feel like I do everything I can to help you prepare yourself so you can be successful.
Okay.
And actually, up to that point, I have seen how you, like from high school, how you got into Stanford and how well you do, you got into Harvard, okay, all this, and how you passed the California bar exam. Every step, every milestone you made, I feel like you're on your way to be successful. Until that point, everything just collapsed. And feel very disappointed, very sad.
That part right there, that my mom had seen my achievements as extensions of her own, that seeing my career so vulnerable had made her feel like her life was out of control, that was a revelation to me. I think I sensed it subconsciously while we were living together, but I didn't have the capacity to empathize with her then, because I too felt very disappointed, very sad. That accomplished, above average Christina of my childhood, youth, and young adulthood, the identity I'd worked so hard to build my entire life, seemed to be fading away at an alarming speed, leaving someone unrecognizable in her place. I felt like I was watching my former self die without knowing who or what I was becoming, and I was terrified.
If you were to try to like guess what is the phrase you repeated to me the most in my whole childhood, what do you think that phrase was?
I think it's probably something like don't waste time.
Is that what you were going to say, Mom?
Yeah, same. Don't waste time. 不要浪费时间.
So why did you say that so often? Like, were you afraid that I was going to waste my life?
You know, I think it's also part of myself, my growing up. The sense of time is related to your preparation for the future. It's like almost like a competition, like a race. If you slow down over a certain period of time, not paying attention, others will surpass you. That kind of thinking actually came from the college entrance exam.
He's talking about the Joint University Entrance Examination, the test that for 48 years determined which Taiwanese high schoolers could go to college after graduation and what college they'd go to. If you failed the exam, you had to wait until the next year to take it again. And in my parents' day, most people failed. The year my dad took the test, the failure rate was 77%.
Everyone was under lots and lots of pressure. Some even committed suicide. Because your life, your future, is totally dependent on that one exam. Even to you know, 20, 30 years later, after even 40 years later, after that exam, people are still having nightmares.
Do you guys ever have any of those nightmares, or are those just stories that you've heard of?
No, I do. Maybe she doesn't, but I would have nightmare that, you know, I would go into an exam and all of a sudden I realize, man, I haven't studied, you know, or I would try to find a classroom. I can't find a classroom. I don't know which building it's going to be in. And I would be running around and ask people. And at the end, I wouldn't be able to find my classroom. In my dream, I knew that I got a PhD from America. And I still can't pass that high school exam. And I was trying to get into a good college in Taiwan, even though I knew I had a PhD in America. It's just weird.
Don't waste your time. Work hard and be successful. Do better than your parents and your peers. It's what got my parents into graduate school in America, into the types of jobs that allowed them to buy a home in California and pay for piano and tennis lessons for me and my sister. It's why my mother pushed so hard to get me into gifted and talented programs. Why they drove the extra 10 miles to a charter school in 7th and 8th grade. Why they made me stay home and study for the SAT all summer instead of hanging out with my friends. Don't waste your time. It wasn't a word of advice. It was a mandate handed down to my parents from their Chinese refugee parents, inscribed into their psyches by growing up in a culture of extreme, high-stakes competition. And it wasn't until I stopped working that I realized how deeply it was inscribed into mine. I didn't grow up in the same environment my parents did. I never had to take that college entrance exam. But the fear of falling behind, of never amounting to anything, of squandering my life, has haunted me for as long as I can remember. During those first few months of rest, I found myself repeating this phrase in my head several times a week. I haven't done anything with my life. When I said it out loud to a friend, he replied, "Didn't you graduate from Harvard Law School? Didn't you just write a book?" I didn't know how to explain to him that none of that mattered if I didn't keep doing better, doing more. That, in fact, I was having a very hard time understanding how my life could matter as long as I kept doing nothing. And now I know why I felt that way. It was all my parents' fault. Just kidding, Mom and Dad. The truth is, I can't blame all of my angst about accomplishments and productivity on my parents. That frantic drive to always be hustling, the belief that it's never enough, it's not just a Taiwanese, Chinese, or immigrant thing. It's an American thing.
This idea of bragging to people, I had an all-nighter last night. We are essentially the workaholics of the world.
This is from a 2019 video by The Atlantic called Work is the New God, featuring Derek Thompson. He's a journalist who's written extensively about contemporary American work culture, or as he calls it, workism. According to Thompson, workism is, quote, the belief that work is not only necessary to economic production, but also the centerpiece of one's identity and life purpose, and the belief that any policy to promote human welfare must always encourage more work. Maybe that's why, according to Samuel P. Huntington, Americans, quote, work longer hours, have shorter vacations, get less in unemployment, disability, and retirement benefits, and retire later than people in comparably rich societies. And it's not just work Americans worship. It's also productivity in the form of self-improvement, what Alexandra Schwartz calls, quote, the hard doctrine of personal optimization. Nowadays, says Schwartz,
it's no longer enough to imagine our way to a better state of body or mind. We must now chart our progress, count our steps, log our sleep rhythms, tweak our diets, record our negative thoughts, then analyze the data, recalibrate, and repeat.
According to Carl Cederstrom and Andre Spicer, authors of Desperately Seeking Self-Improvement, A Year Inside the Optimization Movement, the American self-improvement industry takes in $10 billion a year. And here's where things get even more insidious. For centuries, workism has been closely intertwined with Christianity. Consider this teaching from 15th century Puritan theologian Richard Baxter.
If God show you a way in which you may lawfully get more than in another way, without wrong to your soul or to any other, if you refuse this and choose the less gainful way, you cross one of the ends of your calling, and you refuse to be God's steward, and to accept his gifts and use for him when he requireth it. You may labor to be rich for God, though not for the flesh and sin.
In other words, if you're capable of being more productive and you have the opportunity to do so, It's a sin not to. You're refusing to be God's steward, refusing to bring him glory. I can't tell you how many times I heard messages like this growing up in church. Be excellent for God. Let your light shine by being the best in your field, the hardest worker in your office. Get rich and successful so you can do more to help the poor. By choosing to do nothing indefinitely, I wasn't just letting down my parents. I was letting down my country, God, the poor. But most of all, I was letting down myself. For most of my life, I completely agreed with all of the philosophies I just mentioned. I was committed to honoring my parents' and grandparents' sacrifices by outperforming my peers, to finding that perfect job that would pay me the big bucks to do what I loved, to improving myself in every area of my life constantly, to being excellent for Jesus. The problem was, I hadn't succeeded at any of those things, not to the level I wanted. Every success in my life had a corresponding failure. Like, sure, I'd gone to Harvard Law, but I'd hated it there. I never felt like I fit in, I was a terrible student, and I didn't enjoy being a lawyer. Getting that job with the Amundsens had felt validating. Like, maybe I was hitting my stride. My star was finally on the rise. Sure, maybe law school had been a bust, but at least none of my peers had been offered bespoke dream jobs by billionaire philanthropists yet. At least with my degree and my resume and our book, people would think I had an impressive life. When we stopped working, suddenly, all of the things propping me up from the outside collapsed. I was living in my childhood bedroom at my parents' house. I had no job title, no money coming in, no prospects on the horizon. All I had left were myself and my sad, unfulfilled dreams. In the absence of all of the activity that had defined my life before, I was nothing more than a pathetic 32-year-old who had never quite measured up. And it seemed to grow clear with each passing day that I never would. More on this after the break.
In a pinch, need answers in a cinch. Can you trust God? Surely no, no.
Welcome back to another episode of Can You Trust God? I'm your host, Shirley No-No. Our guest today is Anne from Altadena. Welcome, Anne.
Thanks for having me, Shirley.
Anne, my question is simple. It's the same question I ask my guests every week. Can you trust God?
Yes, I can.
But Anne, didn't God tell you to open up a restaurant in the middle of the pandemic lockdowns?
Yes, he did. And I sure was scared to do it, but...
And now you're on the verge of defaulting on your loans, are you not?
Well, actually, my friends and family have really rallied around. They've started a GoFundMe.
Oh, humiliating, isn't it? Relying on others to bail you out when God just doesn't come through?
Well... I'm not going to lie, it's been a difficult journey, but I still feel that God has...
Disappointed you?
Well, of course I've been disappointed, but God has also...
Left you hanging?
Like I said, it's been such a challenging journey, but I've also grown a lot as a person, so you know...
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have left for today. Thank you, Anne. I'm Shirley No-No. Join us again next week for another episode of Can You Trust God? We'll hear from Colin from Crenshaw.
God told me to sell all my possessions and give them to the poor. And now I'm poor.
Can you trust God? Shirley No-No.
As if it weren't enough to be having an identity crisis that unearthed my deep-seated fear of never measuring up, I was also growing increasingly anxious that we had made the wrong decision. All of those prophetic words that had led us to rest were about transitions and next steps, stepping stones that lit up one after another, a carefree bike ride into the next season. But soon, We were going on our 6th month of not working, and still, no next step was presenting itself. We'd followed the stones into the middle of the water, and there the path seemed to end. We were stranded on Rest Island. Was this where God had been trying to lead us?
It felt like some kind of puzzle you just had to solve.
This, of course, is my fellow castaway, Christian.
The purpose of resting during that time, in my mind, seemed to be like so you could figure out how to make some kind of different pivot or move, like take some, you know, even better route. We had kind of rested and gamed the system, so to speak. And so it felt like this was our next opportunity to game the system some way.
That reference to gaming the system, it's about something that happened right before we met the Amundsens. It was the fall of 2016. Christian was in his last year at Harvard, and I was clerking for the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Court of Appeals. The clerkship was only supposed to last a year, but just 2 months into the job, my judge had asked if I wanted to extend my contract another year. I had every reason to say yes. I loved my job, my judge was a great boss, and we had good friends and a beautiful apartment in Cambridge. But every time we prayed about the decision, we felt like God was saying no. So I turned my judge down. A month later, we met the Amundsens. And by January, they were floating the idea of hiring us to do a special project. But then, months went by with no updates. Meanwhile, Christian's classmates were beginning to interview for jobs after graduation. My colleagues at the appeals court were all looking for their next jobs, too. Christian and I talked about it endlessly. Should we also start applying to jobs? It wasn't clear whether this opportunity with the Amundsens would work out. Maybe they'd forgotten or changed their minds. Looking for jobs seemed like the practical choice. But again, when we prayed about it, we felt like God said not to. 2 months went by, then 3, then 4. Finally, in June, they sent us a proposal for a project. We said yes, right away. And then, once more, heard nothing back for what felt like an eternity. Still, we felt like God was saying to sit tight and wait. It wasn't until mid-July, with the end of our apartment lease right around the corner, that we finally signed the contract. Was it scary to wait? Was it nerve-wracking at times? Of course. But soon enough, that waiting paid off in a big way. The opportunity came through. It was a way cooler job than any of our peers had, and we hadn't even had to fill out an application. We had gamed the system.
So it just felt like, oh, okay, here we're at another crossroads where we're supposed to, like, think outside the box spiritually, and resting is its way of thinking outside the box.
So it was kind of like a...
It's like you like rest...
a shortcut or like yeah. Not like a power move, but like...
Like a power up. It's like a Tanuki suit in Mario when you can, like, fly over the level as opposed to, like, having to do the level.
Uh-huh.
That's what I thought it was. And the difficulty of having to, like, not do things was, to me, hard enough, so.
Like, if you just do this well enough for
enough time,
the right amount of time, you'll get the reward, which is an even better job.
Yeah, some better situation, circumstance. If we put up living here long enough, something is going to open up, even though it's not what I would choose.
So you basically thought that it would kind of be like a repeat of getting the job with the Amundsens. Yeah, just like, on an even better level. Maybe
even. Well, definitely on a better level.
But this didn't feel like a repeat of waiting for the Amundsen job. For one thing, we were both doing stuff while waiting then. Christian was busy with his master's. I had a job. And even if there were gaps in our communications with the Amundsens, we were still communicating. There was still a prospect of things working out if we waited. Now, there was nothing. No hints, no timelines, no tanuki suit.
And as that kept on not happening, how did that make you feel?
I think it felt like either we were doing something wrong. I mean, the real mind F about it was that, like, we were living at your parents' house. If we weren't living at your parents' house, I don't think it would have, like, messed with me so much. But
why
that...
Why did it bother you so much?
It just felt like... It felt like the ultimate failure. I don't even know how to... It did make me rethink, like, my entire life. I was like, wow, what have I done to myself? Because of that, there was just, like, tons of shame every day. So I couldn't really rest because, like, I felt such deep shame at my life and where I was.
Why is it shameful to live at your in-laws' house?
I mean, it was everything. It was like, they live in Irvine, like, which is like, when I first visited you, I was like, oh my gosh, this is Irvine. This is like the suburban, like, you know, purgatory that we all talk about in architecture school. And it like made me laugh. I was like, wow, I know somebody who lives in Irvine now. And then to be living there in your bedroom, I don't know. I guess like to me, it was all the things that I would least want to be doing. And because of the kind of friction that I had with your parents, like when we first were like getting married and like they thought that I was too wild and crazy and like I'd, you know, oh, maybe he's gonna drop out of Harvard too because he dropped out of Yale. And like, I think that made me very, like, I wanted to prove them wrong. And so that's what made it like shameful. It's like, now I'm in a place where I'm eating their food and living off of their hospitality. And
of people who judge you.
Yeah, people that judge me and I'm now proving them right.
If I were to write one of those clickbaity headlines about this time in my life, it would probably go something like, Harvard couple's deepest fears and shame, once hidden beneath layers of work and accomplishment, suddenly rise to the surface like sad, dead goldfish. Pathetic, right? And also too long to be a headline. But you know what? I'd click on it. Because it sounds like the setup for a hero's journey. Isn't that how so many self-help books and Spider-Man sequels start out? One day you're making boku bucks on Wall Street, the next you're checking into rehab for a cocaine addiction. One minute you're saving the world with the Avengers, and the next, all your enemies from every alternate universe come crashing in at once. There's a formula to these stories. The heroes get knocked down, almost crushed. They're forced to reevaluate everything, to learn new ways of being, maybe even take on new identities, all so they can eventually emerge from the darkness and despair stronger than ever. 6 months into doing nothing, I was starting to see our story this way. Like, maybe God hadn't abandoned us. Maybe he'd wanted to strand us on Rest Island to show us how deeply insecure we still were, how scared we still were of proving our doubters right. Rest Island was where we learned we actually had no idea how to rest. But it was where God would teach us. And afterwards, surely, he would send us back into the world better and stronger to keep being heroes. Looking back on that time now, I do think something profound began happening in both of us while we were languishing at my parents' house doing nothing. Even though I couldn't hear what God was saying about our careers, I actually did hear his voice quite often during that time. And the thing he kept saying was, "It's enough." At noon, on a Wednesday, when the dread of another day wasted would start buzzing loudly inside my brain, making me feel crazy, I'd sense that deep, sure knowing again. "It's enough that you're alive, Christina. It's enough that you're breathing, that you're a daughter, a sister, a wife, a friend. You don't need to do more. You're already enough." It's the type of positive, new agey language I would have sneered at before. But now, in my humbled state, I realized I needed to hear it. More than that, I needed to accept it. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life chasing some ever-elusive achievement that would finally prove my worth to me. And by month 6, I think I really was beginning to accept it. Here's an excerpt of an email I wrote to some good friends of ours that month. It reads, "I feel like I get it for the first time. We don't have to strive. We don't have to accomplish, produce, succeed, rinse, and repeat. Yes, God does want us to work, progress, and create, but never out of anxiety or an effort to prove our worth. I understand now that it must begin from a place of rest and surrender. That as we allow his love and perfection to renew us, we will gain the courage, wisdom, and strength to do all the good works he has planned for us. Now, instead of waking up feeling anxious, I'm waking up feeling grateful." I barely remember writing those words. In fact, reading them now kind of makes me cringe. Not because I disagree with them now, but because I sound so sure of myself. So certain we'd finished learning what we were supposed to. I remember having a conversation with my parents around that time, in which we told them we would probably be moving out soon. Christian and I both had another one of those gut feelings that something big was about to change. We thought we were finally going to get that tanuki suit, that another opportunity, even better than the Amundsen job, was about to come our way. My heart still breaks a little, thinking about that version of us. The Christian and Christina who thought life with God could be like a video game, where magical items and power-ups were always just around the corner. Toward the end of that email I write, almost as an aside, "Christian has been experiencing all kinds of weird health issues lately. It seems that God wants Christian to surrender even that to him." I'll give you a guess about what happens next. Here's a hint. It wasn't the tanuki suit. The Last 2 Years is written and produced by me, Christina Gonzalez-Ho, with editing help from Misha Chowdhury and Hannah Weaver. Sound design is by Brandon Lincoln Snyder. Voice acting is by Emily Timmer, Timothy Weaver, Stefan Brackett, and Sharon Pete. Thank you to all of my interviewees whose voices you hear in this episode: Kara Lewis, Vivian Kwong, Chris Childs, Grace Shepline, John Ho, Winchi Chang, and Christian Gonzalez-Ho. And thanks to all of you for listening.